You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this beautiful Tuesday, Election Day 2016. Finally, our long national nightmare is over.
Yes.
Now we can start our new national nightmare.
Chapter two, baby.
That's right. It's like those phantasm movies, you know? But, so we're here today with Mr. Michael Litchens. Michael is the editor of CatholicExchange.com, and we're sitting here, we're chilling. That's what I've done today. I have chilled. I went to Mass, prayed for our country, as you kind of ought to do, especially on this day where we are deciding which... Well, whether we'll swallow the blue pill or the red pill. Swallow the red pill and you
get enlightenment.
You wake up.
You see the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. You swallow the blue pill and you go home, you go to bed, and you wake up believing whatever it is you want to believe. But swallow the red pill, then... right now, Americans all over the country are deciding which pill they want to swallow. And since we don't actually know anything yet and won't start knowing anything until, 8 o'clock East Coast time, right? That's when the
polls... Yeah. Yeah, that's when the polls start closing on the East Coast. And, you know, as they count votes throughout the country, I mean, you can always do exit polls and things like that, but... I don't know. I mean, I still will never forget the 2000 election when by midnight, we still had no clue who won the election. So you never know.
I remember, the following Sunday after that election, I had a priest at the time, one of my favorite priests in the world, Father Michael Sweeney. He's a
great man. One of the best.
Oh, you know him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know all those West Coast guys. So, yes, he's a great man.
So West Coast Dominican guy, and I just love him. He was the president of the Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology for a good long while. And he was my priest. In fact, I dedicated by what authority to him because I just...
He was my very first priest when I was attending a Dominican church in Eugene, Oregon.
Get out!
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's a small world after all. That's amazing. I did not know that.
I didn't know you knew him. This is amazing. So here we are.
Well, here we have something in common. Yes. So he's one of those guys that should write a book, but he's too disorganized to write a book. So instead, he just sort of, you know, just spreads his Dominican genius all over the place. And I have the highest regard for the guy. He is, like my mother, is a Canuck. From British Columbia. He is the closest I have ever gotten to meeting St. Thomas Aquinas. Mm. He's just that kind of guy. He's all light and no heat. He doesn't get upset about things. And when people get upset at him and in his face, he just kind of dispassionately looks at them because clearly they wouldn't be acting this way if they were rational. So they're not rational. And so he... has compassion for them and doesn't get angry back. He's just kind of amazing that way. But the Sunday after the 2000 election, when the electorate was in chaos and they were, you know, examining hanging chads and all the rest of it, he gave a homily because it was getting close to Thanksgiving. No, that's right. It wasn't the Sunday after. It was actually the Thanksgiving homily because we still hadn't figured out of our election by Thanksgiving. And so he gave this homily, and in the course of the homily, he told one of his favorite jokes, which is that It was something Chesterton had remarked one time. Chesterton said that in America, they have a feast to celebrate the arrival of the pilgrims. He said, and in Britain, we should have a feast to celebrate their departure.
Yes.
And in the course of it, he quoted something that Lincoln had said, but in fact, maybe he attributed the founding of Thanksgiving as a national holiday to George Washington, if memory serves, instead of Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came up to him after Mass was over, and I razzed him. And the Canadians had had some election, like shortly after, or we're just about to have some election coming up. And anyway, so I came up to him after his homily and corrected him about whoever had said whatever quote. And then I said, I just want to wish you on this Thanksgiving, I just want to wish you, peace and prosperity from, the freedom-loving people of the United States to the, the monarch-ridden slaves of the Canadian dominions. And he looked at me, sort of dispassionately and cocked an eyebrow, and he said, next week we're going to have an election, and by sundown we're going to know who our prime minister is.
Great comeback.
I see, So that was pretty good. Well, I just ran across this article that just somehow seemed appropriate for not merely Election Day, but especially this Election Day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's titled, In a Mass Knife Fight to the Death Between Every American President, Who Would Win and Why? I thought, well, this seems like promising reading material, So I thought I'd look at this. Yeah, you can find this. There's a website. Looks like it's a blog called Face in the Blue.
Mm-hmm.
So if you Google Face in the Blue and WordPress.com, you can find this guy. And anyway, he says, hello, everyone. One of my most visited sites on the web is Reddit.com. And one of my favorite subreddits is Historical What If, an online community that debates historical hypotheticals. Earlier today, someone asked the question, in a mass knife fight to the death between every American president, who would win and why? Someone beat me to the obvious answer that a final showdown would see Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt doing a dagger-wielding version of a Mexican standoff. So I took it too far and walked through how I thought every president would turn out. An hour later, the result greatly exceeded the maximum 10,000 character limit for a post, so I've decided to blog about it instead. To begin, here were the original conditions of the hypothetical as suggested by the Redditor Zenith. So, number one, every president is in the best physical and mental condition they were ever in through the course of their presidency. Fatal maladies have been cured, but any lifelong conditions or chronic illnesses, so example, FDR's polio, remain. So you don't, it's not post-stroke Woodrow Wilson, it's Woodrow Wilson in his, fit as a fiddle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The presidents are fighting in an ovular arena 287 feet long and 180 feet wide. That is the dimensions of the Roman Colosseum, in case you're wondering. I love that somebody knows that.
And that they felt the need to tell you that. Yes. Like, thank you.
It's not 288 feet long, God forbid. The floor is concrete. Assume that weather is not a factor. So it's a beautiful day for a knife fight. Each president has been given one standard issue Gerber LHR combat knife. The knife presented, get this, the knife presented to each graduate of the United States Army Special Forces Qualification Force. Just so you know, right? Assume the presidents have no training outside any combat experiences they may have had in their own lives. Next, there is no penalty for avoiding combat for an extended period of time. Hiding or playing dead could be valid strategies, but there can be only one winner. The melee will go on as long as it needs to. So this is a fight to the death. FDR, I love this. FDR has been fitted with a Bound Plus H-frame power wheelchair. and could travel at a maximum speed of 11.5 miles per hour. This is like Mad Max. The wheelchair has been customized so that he is holding his knife with his dominant hand. This is to compensate for his almost certain and immediate defeat in the face of an overwhelming disadvantage. Mm. And lastly, each president will be deposited in the arena regardless of their own will to fight. However, personal ethics, leadership ability, tactical expertise, etc., should all be taken into account. Alliances are allowed. With the scenario set, here's my take on it. So, number one, George Washington, commanding presence, strong physique, military training, viewed as a hero by everyone asked to shank him. He makes top 10 without question. Of the guaranteed top three, I'm going to call them the Holy Trinity for the purposes of this rambling rundown. My money is on Jackson being the one who murders him. He wouldn't blink either. They were closer in age, and the hero myth wouldn't quite be as firmly set. Besides, I'm pretty sure Jackson didn't blink when he sneezed. Jackson was just, by the way, just could be crazy, you know? Oh, we're coming up on a break, but we'll keep going here. Number two, John Adams is going out early. Nothing against the man, but portly, well-spoken lawyers bring lampoons to a knife fight. It doesn't end well. Number three, Thomas Jefferson. I'd like to say he'd make a good show of it, but he was a bit of a dandy, middle of the pack, but his dying words would be incredibly quotable.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
We will continue this fascinating examination after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm host Mark Jay. Here today with Michael Litchin. We'll be back talking about which presidents would survive a mass knife fight right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Michael Litchins, the editor of CatholicExchange.com. And we are discussing the extremely important Election Day question of, in a mass knife fight between all the presidents of the United States who have ever lived, should survive. We've already looked at, we just looked at Thomas Jefferson. not likely to survive, but his dying words would be incredibly quotable.
Yes.
So we're up to president number four, James Madison. He's just too short. I'm sorry. You need reach in a knife fight. The bravado of the philosophy behind Manifest Destiny only gets you so far. He'll die early, and his small corpse would be one of the least important tripping hazards as the battle wears on. It's important to read these things because then you get a little history lesson. You hear phrases like Absolutely. Manifest destiny, and you go, what is manifest destiny? And then someone like me comes along and tells you and says, manifest destiny is translated as, in German, it's translated as Lebensraum. It means the same thing. It means we're powerful and we have a technological civilization and you Indians aren't so tough. Get out of the way or mm-hmm. die. Or get out of the way and die. We don't really care because we're taking your land.
That's right. It was a more militant form of what we now call American exceptionalism.
Right, it's, yeah.
You know, we're a special people and there's specific virtues that we have as an American people and our institutions and, you know, all these things make us this great nation that is just going, God has blessed so much that we're just going to conquer everything that we want right. to well, from sea to shining sea.
You know, there's actually a speech, I don't have it in front of me, but it's in, I have a copy of it that I put in my book, Mary Mother of the Sun. It's a speech made by Senator Thomas Hart Benton on Manifest Destiny. And it's really, it could be Hitler talking about Ukrainians and Poles. It's just, God has called us to do this, and these inferior races simply have no right to stand in our way. But anyway, moving on, James Monroe, our fifth president. It's surprisingly difficult to say how he'd do, because he's just so damned unmemorable. An argument could be made that he'd last a while for the simple reason that his opponents would try to place him. Who are you again? That would be distracting. Monroe, by the way, is the author of the Monroe Doctrine, which most people don't remember, but which actually is still basically in force. And the Monroe Doctrine basically said that everything in the entire Western Hemisphere is under our protection, even though these are not countries over which we have any jurisdiction.
Right.
And so if Europe does anything, dinks around in any way with these other countries, then somehow it's an affront to us because we're fantastically arrogant.
And it's our backyard.
It's our backyard. So you do something in South America, then it's an affront to us. It's like, seriously? You know? But yeah.
I think the other countries might have a say in this. Nope.
No, they don't. Shut up. So let's see. John Quincy Adams. That man had a murderer's face, a murderer's eyes, and a murderer's haircut. Based on these intimidating characteristics alone, I'm going to say he makes top 10. If he teams up with dear old dad and they watch each other's back, they might even become crowd favorites until the portly lawyer is overcome by a rabid Jackson, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt assault.
Which, by the way, are the three figures that he thinks will come out on top in all this thing.
Yeah, those are the guys that he assumes is going to come out on top. So, Andrew Jackson. It's already been said the man's nickname was Old Hickory because he walked around town with a bludgeon that to the untrained eye was a walking stick. A man who can beat a would-be assassin within an inch of his life with a cane is going to be a murder machine when provided with an implement designed to end a man's life. I think of the top three, he'd be reckless enough to go down first, but he'd also probably have the highest overall kill count. Then we get to Martin Van Buren. You know, it's amazing how many B-list presidents there are, by the way. I'm just throwing this out there. There's
a
lot of presidents you're like, was that guy a president? I'm not even sure, you know. So anyway,
The greatest thing about these B-list presidents is that you'll occasionally be in a state and you'll be like, oh, this is a home where such and such president was born. You're like, I don't know who the heck that guy is, but I'm glad to see his house, I guess.
I was so happy. A few years ago, I was out in Ohio, out visiting Franciscan media in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And they put me up in a hotel for the night. And this hotel, I think it was called the Garfield Hotel, if memory serves. Ohio has the distinction of having more presidents come from Ohio than any other state. Which is kind of surprising. You'd think it would be Virginia, but it's not. And anyway, so you go up to this one floor, and all the suites are named for presidents. So I had the distinction of staying in the Warren G. Harding suite, which made me really happy. Speaking of real zero presidents who are like totally unmemorable. But anyway.
Likewise, when I lived in New Hampshire, I constantly saw, because his family owned like three or four houses, Franklin Pierce stuff. And I, to this day, really have little knowledge of who the heck this guy is. So
he was a general in the Mexican War, is the main thing I know. And somehow or other, he died because he ate too many sour apples. And it killed him. Which is like the second dumbest death for an American president, I think. The dumbest death, which will come up on here in just a moment, is the death of William Henry Harrison.
Yes.
Who, yeah. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But Martin Van Buren. I'm going to put it out there. Jackson and Van Buren may have formed a pact early on. They were friendly as anyone ever gets with Jackson. Plus, when he shouted obscenities in his native Dutch, it might have spooked the presidents of the 20th century, whose military service included time fighting the Germans. I'm going to say he makes middle of the pack before Jackson forgets who his friends are and tears into him like a Wolverine. Number nine, William Henry Harrison, the man's most famous for dying on his 32nd day in office. I know the hypothetical puts him in his prime, but I think the fact that every president after him considers him feeble means he'll be hunted down and eliminated early. William Henry Harrison died because, like every good 19th century politician, he was a total windbag. And this is back in the days when presidents were inaugurated in early March, not on January 20th.
Yes.
And so he went out there at his inauguration, and he gave this speech that never ended in this gale. It was just raining and blowing and terrible and cold, and he just sat out there and gave this windbag speech that nobody remembers. And by the time he was done, he had caught pneumonia, and he died a month later, and that was it. Mm-hmm. So, there were never really about the minutes after his giving his oath of office were the healthiest he ever was in office. So there we go. John Tyler, another president you don't remember. The only reason you remember John Tyler, you know?
No. Other than that, he took over William Henry Harrison, and no one knows.
The only possible reason you might remember John Tyler is because the slogan of the Harrison Tyler ticket, because Harrison had fought in the Battle of Tippecanoe. And so their slogan was Tippecanoe and Tyler too, which nobody remembers today except for me, because I'm a dork who remembers crap like that. But anyway. So anyway, John Tyler. No one liked John Tyler, especially Team Jackson Van Buren. Not only would he be hunted down, but he would have an unmemorable death unless Van Buren tries to go for style points. 5 minutes into the scrap, people would ask each other, who was that again? Why is Jackson wearing a scalp as a beret? James K. Polk, another B-list president. Although he does have the distinction of having a song written about him by They Might Be Giants.
Yes.
So that's important. Have you heard that?
Oh, yeah. That's the only reason why I know who he is.
Yeah. Mr. James K. Polk, the Napoleon of the Stomp. Okay. So anyway, James Polk, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. That man had some grit and gumption and more than his share of character. He said what he meant, and he did what he said. He will not be one of the early deaths, although I think the top 10 escapes him for a simple lack of ambition. Promising to serve a single term and then following through on that promise, he doesn't dream big enough to escape the knives of the Holy Trinity. So, number 12, Zachary Taylor, old, rough, and ready. He had a 40-year military career fighting men armed with hatchets. I like his odds in a knife fight. I really do. Top 10 for sure. Top 5 is not unrealistic. This is a man to watch, folks. If Lincoln and Jackson give him an inch, he'll bury 6 inches between their ribs. And Roosevelt righteous indignations him to death. We will continue this survey right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Michael Litchens, and we'll be back just in a few.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hey-o! Welcome back! connect dots. Here today with Michael Litchens. We're basically having a goof-off show today. This is like, we're not having, we haven't had any heavy, deep, and real conversations about Catholic teaching today because, you know, just not doing that. It's election day, and there's been enough angst, and everybody's freaking out.
No, exactly. And as Thomas Aquinas said, sometimes you just need wine, a bath, and a good night's rest.
This is the virtual digital version of that. As we go through the important discussion of if you had all the presidents of the United States in a mass knife fight, who would win? And I think that's a very important thing for us to consider. So we're up to President 13, Millard Fillmore. Or is it Millard or Millard Fillmore? I'm not sure.
I think it's Millard, but I could be wrong.
Okay. So anyway, Millard Fillmore, I'm not writing this. This is from an essay that was published on the Face in the Blue blog. So, Millard Fillmore, let's be honest, weak character, unmemorable fellow, a little stout all his life, boring. No part of this guy suggests he's going to come out well. Dead early, and only the presidents alive during his lifetime are even good to know whose corpse they keep tripping over. Franklin Pierce. In his prime, he was a soldier in an era where bayonets were the main thing that got the job done. He also had a touch of madness in his eye in his official portrait. I'm going to say he makes it to the middle of the fight. Beyond that, I can't say. Number 15, James Buchanan. I think my own personal opinion is that after FDR, James Buchanan is the first to die. But let's see what this guy says. I'm going to put it out there. I think he'd be picked on. I believe at least half the presidents after his time would want to be the guy to murder Buchanan. Good reason for wanting to murder Buchanan. Dead early, and his corpse would be stabbed a few times to make sure, and only Harriet Lane, his niece, is left to mourn him. James Buchanan is the president who basically did nothing, leaving Abraham Lincoln with a spot of bother. Abraham Lincoln is one of the Holy Trinity of this rumble. I put him ahead of Jackson and behind Teddy Roosevelt, but it really would be a sight to see. Number 17, Andrew Johnson. I've got to be honest. This is one of the rare lapses in my understanding of history. Maybe Johnson was a badass, but my suspicion is that despite coming up from nothing, he was a lifelong politician who couldn't make friends. He was the first impeached president, someone within his generation is going to have a grudge, and I don't know what mitigating circumstances he has to defend himself. Dead early. Number 18, U.S. Grant, a career soldier and a mean drunk, ruthless, comfortable with blood on his hands, formidable physically. I think Grant is going to do very well. Top 10, certainly, and maybe he battles with Polk and Taylor for number 5 outside the Holy Trinity. Rutherford B. Hayes was wounded 5 times in the Civil War. I did not know that. He was a big guy, and he didn't lack for courage. That said, he was a bit of a straight shooter and more than a little bit of a straight arrow. Principles can get in the way of winning a knife fight. Also, that beard is begging someone to take it in their fist and throw him off balance. I see him making the later half of the scrap, but not the top 10 unless he catches a lucky break. James Garfield. I respect the man, and he served in the Civil War, but I just don't know enough about his service and physique to make more than an educated guess. He'd hold his own in a fight, but the Holy Trinity would see the end of him at some point. Number 21, Chester A. Arthur had the build of a brawler, but even in his prime, I wonder if his poor health would be a handicap. Dead in the first half, but certainly not among the first dead. Then we got to Grover Cleveland. Grover Cleveland is... what is the amazing distinction about Grover Cleveland? Do you remember?
I don't, as a matter of fact, other than... Oh, wait, did he oversee our first, like, major economic collapse?
That I don't know. What I do know is that he was our 22nd president, then he lost to Benjamin Harrison, then he came back as our 24th president.
Oh, so that's right.
To serve 2 non-consecutive terms. So there you go. Mm. He paid a man $150 so he wouldn't have to fight in the Civil War. Even his biographer said his qualities were typical rather than unusual. I'm going to say among the first 20 dead. Number 23, Benjamin Harrison. I wonder if he'd try to get to know his grandfather, the marked for death William Henry Harrison and therefore leave himself vulnerable to a quick shanking. I don't know enough about him to say otherwise, so I envision a family reunion and ending cruelly and bloodily fairly early in the festivities. Let's see. William McKinley, the man is famous for sitting on his porch and letting the party machine do the heavy lifting. A calm head and broad shoulders might see him through the early fracas, but I think he lacks the fire in the belly required to make his mark. Dead in the first half. McKinley has the distinction of being murdered in my dad's hometown. He was killed in Buffalo, New York at the Centennial Exposition. And when he picked Theodore Roosevelt for his running mate, the party bosses said, now that damned cowboy is one heartbeat away from the presidency. And then that heart stopped beating. So so there we go. Theodore Roosevelt, the man, the legend, a member of the Holy Trinity, and my personal favorite to come out on top. Anyone who gets shot at the start of a long speech and delivers the whole thing anyway, a man who beat asthma by strength of character and who lost vision in one of his eyes while boxing in the White House, has the tenacity to endure more than a few knife wounds if he thinks he's right and everyone else is wrong. Let's also not forget how much time this man spent with a skinning knife in his hand. The Smithsonian is a monument to this man's ability to butcher creatures of all shapes and sizes. It's true. He sent back tons of specimens to the Smithsonian from all of his hunting trips and all that. He also liked to call his enemies cowards, and the force of his personality could easily unbalance those who would try to argue against his will.
Oh, my gosh.
This is so great.
And another great story from Theodore Roosevelt's life. There's a famous painting. It's probably John Singer Sargent's most famous portrait of Teddy Roosevelt. And the reason why Roosevelt's posed in this very physically intimidating way is because Roosevelt was turning around to yell at Sargent about taking up too much of his time. And Sargent said, hold that pose.
That's great.
And he hated him.
Do that.
Because he's, hands on a banister, another hand's on his hip, and he's clearly ready to lay down the law. And it's like, oh, hold that pause. There we go. Painting that.
There's probably the most famous, well-known portrait of Winston Churchill that you've ever seen is that one black and white photo of him sort of glowering at the camera. The guy that took that picture, Churchill had a cigar. Mm-hmm. And the guy who was taking the picture just reached over and just grabbed the cigar out of his mouth.
Oh, my gosh.
And then took the picture, like, the moment after he took the picture. And so Churchill's just like, grrr, you know?
Yeah.
And Churchill loved that shot. He loved that picture. So anyway.
Understandable.
William Howard Taft. This might be the first guy to die, actually. What did that man look like in his prime? I suspect even at his most physically fit, he could go toe-to-toe with the stereotypical 21st century Walmart patron. I just don't think he was ever healthy enough to make a good showing in this arena. Dead early, and his corpse might well be used as a low wall or some sort of artificial hill to lend advantage to his conquerors. Okay. Number 28, Woodrow Wilson, a brilliant mind and a delicate physique, dead very early. If Teddy Roosevelt in his prime knew that Wilson would be president after him, I suspect Wilson would be a hunted man early in the fight. Number 29, Warren G. Harding, was a lover, not a fighter, dead in the first half, although I'm not entirely opposed to the idea of his surprising all of us and making a long way before his inevitable defeat. Calvin Coolidge is number 30. He made a name for himself as a man of action during the Boston police strike, but I don't think he'd have the staying power to see through a knife fight. I'm prepared to be wrong, but I just don't know enough about him to venture an opinion beyond what I've already said. Herbert Hoover, number 31. I think Truman would help him in the early stages of the fight, but there were enough presidents who grew up during the Great Depression who might like to settle a childhood animosity or two. He wouldn't be long for this world in a fight with the greatest generation.
Oh, gosh.
let's see. Number 32, FDR. In this scenario, has a pretty impressive chair, and that's going to protect a lot of his vital organs, give him a low center of gravity, and otherwise lend him an advantage not available to other presidents. Plus, one-third of the Holy Trinity, Uncle Teddy, isn't out to murder him and might even back him up. I see Frankie D going far, but at some point, Old Hickory or Honest Abe is going to be spooked by the futuristic chair and lash out. That'll be the end of him. Number 33, Harry S. Truman would make a good show of things, but he was a little guy. No reach, no intimidation. That said, he keeps calm under pressure and is willing to make hard decisions. I definitely think he'd be a major force early on, perhaps even delivering the coup de grace on those left suffering. Number 34, Dwight D. Eisenhower has a solid military background, and in his prime, he would have been a force to be reckoned with. That said, his penchant for negotiation and seeking consensus is going to infuriate Andrew Jackson. When that madman comes after Ike without anyone to pull them apart, it will be a duel worthy of a 14-part, 20-second in real time anime epic. We will be back right in the, after this on Connecting the Dots, talking about which of the presidents were the best life sweet to the other presidents. We'll be back to my glitchiness right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Hello and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Michael Litchens, and we're just kind of goofing around here. We're going through this article. It's answering the extremely important question of which presidents would survive if they were all put together in the Roman Colosseum and bidden to do a mass knife fight to the death. So we're up to President Kennedy, number 35. What was his prime? This is part of the rules that they have to, they would be as they were in their prime while they're having this knife fight. So not, you know, post-stroke Woodrow Wilson, but Woodrow Wilson in the peak of vim and vigor. So what was President Kennedy's prime? When did he get the bad back and Addison's disease? JFK would go down swinging and he'd leave a beautiful, charismatic corpse. Maybe he makes top 10 and certainly he makes it through the early melee. Beyond that, I don't dare speculate. Number 36, Lyndon Johnson was a giant of a man, a Texan, and more than a bit of an a-hole, too. Mm-hmm. He would be a force to be reckoned with, absolutely, top 10, possibly, and a staying power throughout the struggle. Beyond that, it's not up to me. Richard Nixon doesn't have the physique to go the distance in a battle like this, but I think he had the cunning and the drive to live a lot longer than the majority. I worry that he'd try to take on Kennedy or Johnson early, which might be the end of him. That said, maybe he can convince Jackson to do his dirty work for him. Gerald Ford was another big guy, but I suspect he had too soft a heart for a knife fight. He would defend himself, certainly, but would he hunt down the weak and give them the old cold steel? At some point, the hesitation would catch up with him. Number 39, Jimmy Carter and a knife fight is a comical thought to me. Among the first dead would be my suspicion. Okay. Ronald Reagan looks like he would know a thing or two about brawling, and he spent a lot of his prime in either the military or playing a cowboy. I expect he'd go far, but not far enough. 20 years after the battle, people will rewrite the fight to make him a lion among bobcats. But that's mostly driven by nostalgia. Number 41, George H.W. Bush gets painted as an intellectual, but he was a war hero and a head of the CIA. I'm also confident his son would team up with him from the very beginning. They'd make a formidable team, and I would expect great things from the two of them. Number 42, Bill Clinton is another big guy, but he's a lover, not a fighter. He'd give it his very best shot, but I hesitate to say he'd last very long at all. Number 43, George W. Bush would team up with his father, and the two of them, at their prime, would be a match for just about anyone outside the Holy Trinity. That said, of the two of them, he'll be the weak link when he stumbles and his father will overextend himself trying to help. My expectation is they'll die within moments of each other, but probably surrounded by heaps of their foes. 44. This was published, by the way, in 2012. 44. Barack Obama, for all his wonderful qualities, is not a scraper. I think he meant to say scrapper. He probably tried to negotiate an end to hostilities, and while seeking middle ground, some loon would get the better of him. In an arena full of knife-wielding war veterans, I don't hold out a lot of hope that he'd make it through the first few minutes. And scene. Oh, and then he writes this little addendum. This is already by far my most popular post in the last 3 years with 67,000 viewers. That was written in 2012. I'm sure there's been zillions more since. Oh, of course, I'm delighted that you've all enjoyed it so much, and I apologize to all of you more knowledgeable on the subject matter than I am. I will not make any major edits to the content, but I acknowledge that I failed to sell Lincoln, underestimated Carter's nerve, oversold Grant and Johnson, and could have spent a lot more than an hour fleshing this out into a detailed orgy of historically accurate violence. Cheers. So there you are.
Yes.
Inspiring. Something, you know, that's something for us to look forward to, is a new entry into the presidential Hunger Games as of tomorrow. And that's why I want Jennifer Lawrence for president. Wouldn't that be awesome? She would be so great. Well, they could, you know, she can play Hillary in the biopic. So young Hillary Clinton, they'll cast her as young Hillary Clinton or something. So
We still need biopics of other people, presidents in my lifetime. Not yet, guys.
Yeah. You know, well, you were talking about somebody before the show started that I think totally should have a... There needs to be a whole new slew, I think, of really great Lives of the Saints on film.
Yes.
I would love to see Moses the Egyptian... his life story put into a movie, because that guy was tough, man.
I mean, yeah, he's one of those guys, you know. I mean, part of his conversion experience is he broke into a monastery to rob it. I mean,
really?
Yeah, that was part of his conversion experience. And also he went back to that same monastery because he needed to hide from the former gang that he was murdering and robbing with. Okay. And he stayed there.
This sounds a little bit like Les Miserables. You know?
Oh, very much so. He's one of my favorite saints. If you ever read the Desert Fathers, he has so much great wisdom and about redemption. But then you hear his life story that was written by some of the monks who served with him in the deserts of Egypt near Alexandria. Uh-huh. And it's like, oh my gosh, how on earth did that? How did he convert, of all people?
Uh-huh.
He did, and then he became one of the most powerful monks in terms of his words and his Christian charity.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I love those kinds of stories. There's a million saint stories out there that really, they're just crackerjack stories. I mean, these really interesting people, you know, with really checkered pasts. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another Egyptian saint, I don't remember her name, but I'm sure you probably know her story. She was a prostitute.
Saint Catherine of Alexandria.
No, that's not who I'm thinking of. It's somebody else. I can't remember her name. But anyway, she was just, you know, I mean, the thing about North African Christianity in particular is it just produced these, like, incredibly extreme people who just, you know, they were just tough as nails, and they would do these amazing things. Yeah, you know, Simeon Stylites was, if memory serves, was part of the North African community. And you know, so it had its good sides and its kind of upside and its downside, because you know, on the good side, it produced these saints who were just unbelievably tough, and when they set their mind to obeying God, they were just forces of nature. Nothing could stop them, and they would do crazy things to show their devotion, like sit on a pillar for, you know, 10, 20 years, you know.
Yes.
And you know, people would haul their waste away and bring food to them. And that's what they did. They were just sitting on this pillar all day. You know, it was just like, dang, that's just not something I think I'd like to do, you know. But the downside of it was, of course, when you get all these people who are like kind of crazy gung-ho for Jesus, they could also just be, it's really easy to move from being able to take persecution really well to being able to dole it out really well. And, you know, but the fathers of the church, the desert fathers, are just these amazing characters. And so attractive in so many ways, while also being incredibly kind of scary.
Oh yeah. No, especially those desert fathers. I think it about like some of them, like, were in the wild for so long and no one had any idea they went into the wild of the desert. No one had any idea someone was out there. And so travelers would talk about stumbling on these monks who had a beard so long it would cover them if they didn't have clothing. It's like,
wow,
what kind of crazies are we running into out here?
Yeah. But, you know, they did things like they invented monasticism. I mean, those are the guys that came up with monasticism. And some of their stories are just so charming. I mean, you can't help but love them, you know. And they would do these odd things, you know, to illustrate their point, you know. I remember reading about one of the fathers who, I forget, somebody was, you know, sort of trying to enlist them in, you know, being angry at some other Christian for doing something that they didn't like. And he went and got a sack and he filled it with sand.
That was St. Moses.
Yeah. Oh, really? Was that St. Moses? And then he poked a hole in it and it was just, and he says, you know, all my sins are running out behind me and you want me to spend all my time chewing this guy out, you know, and judging this guy, you know? It was just like, well, that was an odd way to make that point, you know, but, very much in a lot of ways, very much in the tradition of the Jewish prophets. The Jewish prophets did bizarre things sometimes to illustrate their point. You know, hi, I'm Ezekiel, and in order to make my point, allow me to build a little model of the city of Jerusalem and then strip naked and lie on my side next to it for a year. There is a point to all this, right? And yeah, so I love the fathers. They do such strange things.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Michael Litchens.
My pleasure.
If you haven't gone and you've not gone and voted today, go and vote. This is your big chance to change the course of history. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We've been here today with Michael Litchens. Our producer today was Danny Head, and we'll be back tomorrow with Rod Bennett with our post-apocalyptic show. Until then, have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.